Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Tides of History early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts.
The snow had been falling for days now. An icy January wind, the coldest January anybody could remember, blew the flakes in great swirling gusts. Here, amid those gusts, a small group of men was trudging through the January cold. Scarves covered their mouths. Their hats were pulled low over ears, barely fending off frostbite. It was impossible to see more than a few feet in front of them. It was also impossible to walk more than a few feet without running into a large bump in the field, half buried in the drifts of snow. These weren't natural bumps in the rolling landscape of Lorraine. They were corpses, the bodies of the ill-fated army the Duke of Burgundy had led here to besiege the city of Nancy in the depths of a freezing winter. 2 days before, on January 5th, 1477, the Duke's army had been utterly destroyed in just a few minutes of fighting. Swiss mercenaries with pikes and halberds, city militiamen from Strasbourg, hardened men-at-arms from Lorraine and France. They had utterly crushed the forces of Charles the Bold, the Duke of Burgundy, and a king in all but name. Most of his men had died where they stood. But Charles the Bold was missing. No one had seen him since the day of the battle. Confused reports had him fleeing on horseback, already injured. Beyond that, nobody had any idea. That is what brought this group of men out into a freezing December snowstorm. "Is that him?" a Swiss mercenary asked. Most of the men were Swiss or Lorrainers, here to confirm that the Duke had either escaped or, better, died with his men on the battlefield. The others, captured members of Charles's entourage, had been dragged out to identify the corpse of their former master. "Not him, too young," came the reply. The speaker's voice was young, strongly accented by the flavors of Northern Italy. "Definitely not," said another. This accent was Portuguese and belonged to an older, distinguished-looking man. "Check this one over here," said another. He pointed to a body half drowned in a small stream. The dead man had been stripped naked from the waist up, and he had suffered gruesome injuries. His face was unrecognizable, split in two from the blow of a Swiss halberd. "Could be," said the Italian. He leaned down and saw reddish-brown hair and long fingernails, just as the Duke had. The Italian had been the Duke's page. "The scars look right," said the Portuguese, pointing to a distinct band of jagged tissue on a muscular arm. He had been the Duke's doctor. "I sewed that one up last year. That's him," he said. Charles the Bold, Duke of Burgundy, and one of the most powerful and dangerous men in Europe, was officially dead. His many enemies, from the King of France himself down to a humble Swiss farmer-turned-mercenary, would be ecstatic to hear the news. He had no sons to inherit his vast and wealthy lands. The race was on to carve up the Duke's territories. The map of Europe would never be the same. Hi, everybody. From Wondery, welcome to another episode of Tides of History. As always, I'm Patrick Wyman. Thanks so much for joining me today. The second half of the 15th century was home to some of the bloodiest clashes and the most compelling leaders of the entire Middle Ages. We've spent a few weeks now talking about them, about the bitter decades-long Wars of the Roses in England, the civil wars in France and Iberia, and the powerful and rich Dukes of Burgundy and the collection of territories they acquired across Northern Europe. This was a time of deep conflict that tore the political world of Europe apart at the seams. This time was also marked by the rocky rise of states, the ancestors of the modern political units we take for granted. The medieval political map featured a bewildering variety of kingdoms, duchies, counties, lordships, margraviates, prince bishoprics, semi or fully independent city-states, and alliances of towns. Theoretically, dukes and counts and the lands they controlled might be beholden to something greater than themselves, to the King of France, to the Holy Roman Emperor, or what have you. But in practice, they might be anywhere from fully dependent to fully independent. The map was full of players, each of whom staked out claims to rights, rights to everything from taxation to the use of the legal system. Competing claims to those rights drove much of late medieval political conflict on every scale, from the local to the international. Let's say you've got a tax on salt in a coastal town. Who has the right to collect the tax on that salt? The local bishop? The lord whose lands surround the town? The king? Or the town itself? On a higher level, did the king of France or the duke of Burgundy have the right to administer justice in the duke's lands? Could the duke of Austria tell the Swiss towns what to do? Did the Duke of York or the Duke of Somerset have the right to rule England when the king was incapacitated? Who would inherit the claim to a vacant duchy whose lord had just died? These kinds of issues were the bread and butter of politics in this period. The second half of the 15th century saw the settling of many of these competing claims, some of which had been thorny issues for centuries. When they got settled, it was usually in the direction of the king. The regnal polity, to borrow a term from the political historian John Watts, is what was rising in this period. The collection of claims gathered in the person of the king, with an apparatus of government around him to help him do what he wanted. The king belonged to a dynasty, a family that passed these claims from generation to generation. That apparatus of government is what we call the state. Thus, we have the dynastic state, the dominant political form of this period. Under the leadership of a talented generation of kings, these dynastic states consolidated the political map in their favor. They shut out competitors, they built their bureaucracies and their capacity for control, and they acquired ever more territory. Today, we're going to talk about precisely how those dynastic states went about taking over ever larger chunks of the map. To do that, we're going to focus on one episode. The fight for the hand of Mary of Burgundy, heiress to the Duchy of Burgundy. The conflict that grew out of this marriage encapsulates everything we need to know about how the dynastic states of this period actually rose, if we can say that they really did. Last week, we ended with the death of Charles the Bold, Duke of Burgundy, Count of Flanders, and ruler of a whole bunch else besides. Charles was a king in all but name, and he had tried repeatedly to get himself a royal crown during his 10 years as duke. His lands were among the richest and most productive in all of Europe, a band of territory stretching from the cities of Flanders and the marshy coasts of Holland down through Luxembourg, the Rhineland, and into Burgundy in eastern France. His ambitions stretched even further than what he already controlled. Charles the Bold fancied himself a great soldier, and most of his reign bore that out. The last 11 months of his life were less promising. Charles suffered two serious defeats against an alliance of the Swiss, the Duke of Lorraine, and several of the Rhine cities. A third defeat, outside the walls of the city of Nancy in the depths of the winter of 1477, would be the last. Amid a swirling snowstorm in the dead of winter, a motley assortment of Swiss mercenaries, Lorrainer knights, and city militia crushed the tiny army Charles had left. As we saw at the beginning, it took 2 days for the Duke's body to be found. Stripped naked, face down in a stream, the head split in two, identifiable only because of its long fingernails and a series of scars. The memoirist Philippe de Comines, who knew him well, gave him this epitaph. Quote, "He would have liked to resemble those princes of antiquity who remained so famous after their death. And he was as daring as any man who ruled in his time. But all his projects are over, and they all turned to his prejudice and shame. For those who win get all the honor." The dynasty of the Valois Dukes of Burgundy died with Charles the Bold. For 114 years, the duchy and its associated territories had passed smoothly from father to son. From Philip the Bold to John the Fearless, to Philip the Good, to Charles the Bold. But Charles the Bold, unlike his predecessors, had no adult male heir to succeed him. He did have one daughter, a 19-year-old named Mary of Burgundy. Slim and active, fond of hunting and riding, with a round face and the long, narrow Valois nose, she was still unmarried. That was a rarity for high-born women of this age. Charles had explored a variety of options for her, including the sons of the King of France, the Holy Roman Emperor, and the brother of the King of England. But nothing had been set in stone before his death. Now, with Mary's father dead, the choice of husband took on far greater political importance. Whoever married Mary of Burgundy stood to take over the richest single chunk of available territory in all of Europe. The choice would mark a new beginning in European power politics and set the course for more than two centuries of dynastic conflict. As her father desperately tried to retreat from the battlefield at Nancy and instead met the business end of a Swiss halberd, Mary of Burgundy was safely ensconced in the Flemish city of Ghent, some 220 miles away. Everything changed when news of Charles the Bold's death thundered down the frozen January roads and arrived in Ghent. She had no money. The vast wealth of Burgundy had disappeared into the pockets of thousands of mercenaries, cannon founders, siege engineers, and military suppliers. She had no soldiers. The bare 5,000 men with whom her father had besieged Nancy were now mostly dead. They had been the last available troops. Her extensive lands were surrounded by ambitious and greedy enemies, especially the King of France, Louis XI. Her own subjects were independent-minded and rebellious. Only the heavy hand of the Valois dukes had kept them in line. This would have been a dangerous situation for the most seasoned and competent political operator, much less a 19-year-old with no certain allies. Events moved with extreme speed after Charles fell at Nancy. The duke's death lit a crisis that touched every corner of Europe. Now, technically speaking, the King of France, Louis XI, had been uninvolved in the events that led to the duke's death. He hadn't been there at the inn. He hadn't been a part of the alliance that brought him down. He hadn't sent an army to Nancy. But in reality, Louis and the Duke of Burgundy had been mortal enemies. Louis had worked to bring Charles down for years, and vice versa. Louis was known as the Universal Spider for the webs of diplomacy and intrigue he wove around his opponents. After years of conflict, Charles had finally fallen victim to an alliance of Swiss and Lorrainers. Louis played some role in assembling that alliance. In one version of this story, Louis single-handedly drove Charles toward his death. In the more likely version, Louis simply sweetened the pot for the Swiss and the Lorrainers and nudged things in the right direction. But either way, Louis was the one who had sought and stood to benefit most from Charles's death. The memoirist Comines had previously served Charles the Bold before jumping ship to work for Louis XI. He was present when the King of France got the news of Charles's defeat, just days after it happened. Quote, "The king at first was so overjoyed at the news that he hardly knew what face to put on." Imagine the king's expression, sharp eyes looking down a long, crooked nose at the lords who brought him the messenger's letters. His craggy, aging face twisting between joy and satisfaction and deep thought at the possibilities the news presented. The outcome Louis had sought for years had finally come to pass. The Duke of Burgundy brought low, humbled, maybe even dead. It was too delicious for the Universal Spider to contemplate. This conflict with Charles the Bold had been more than a matter of state policy. It was personal, strategic interest colliding with the fundamental dislike the two men shared for one another. Louis took only a little time to gloat and then sprang into action. Many of Charles the Bold's vast holdings were technically part of the Kingdom of France. Flanders, Picardy, Artois, and the Duchy of Burgundy itself. Only the Duke's power and the often precarious position of the French kings had alienated those lands from central influence and control. In the absence of a male heir, Louis could mount a strong claim to have them revert back to the French crown. At the very least, Louis could reestablish some overlordship. And if he played his cards right, he might get even more besides. Charles had, in fact, died on January 5th, a fact that Louis quickly became aware of. By January 18th, Louis was on his way north to the vast swath of Burgundian lands that encircled the northern limits of France like a crescent moon. Louis had already dispatched envoys and officials ahead of him to lay the groundwork for the reabsorption of these territories. His plan was to take over everything he could lay reasonable claim to, namely the French lands. He would then distribute the imperial lands, the other chunk of territory belonging to the Dukes of Burgundy, as a way of building alliances with foreign princes, princes of the Holy Roman Empire. If Louis got his way, never again would the Burgundian lands be a threat to him or to France. The officials Louis sent out made promises and sussed out potential alliances. The Burgundian lands were unusually full of local power brokers, urban elites and nobles, who had their own interests to protect. Those were interests that the King of France could exploit and advance to gain control of these lands. The Duchy of Burgundy itself, that big block of territory in eastern France, came to terms quickly. By the beginning of February, its estates, the representative body, had agreed to a reunion with France. The Burgundian territories along the English Channel and the great towns of Picardy, like Amiens, came back quickly as well. In case the other areas should prove less willing, Louis's couriers were calling up soldiers and preparing an army. This was a nice illustration of the tools available to the ruler of a dynastic state: velvet glove and iron fist, carrot and stick. A ruler could both offer incentives for the elites of his would-be lands through delicate negotiation and compel them through raw force. Either way, driving north through the coldest winter anybody could remember, weathering snow and ice and the frozen roads of northern France, Louis XI meant to get back what he considered to be his. Meanwhile, in the Flemish city of Ghent, some 300 miles away from Louis, Mary of Burgundy anxiously awaited any news. With her father dead and the powerful, wily King of France on the move, her situation looked dire. Recent events within Ghent had made it even worse. Ghent had always been fractious and independent-minded, going back centuries. It had resented the rule of the Counts of Flanders and fought them long before the Valois Dukes of Burgundy were even a thing. Only raw force and fragile compromise had kept them in line during the rule of Charles the Bold, who had taxed them heavily and limited their rights and privileges. The moment they learned Charles was dead, the citizens of Ghent seized the chief magistrates within the city and the wealthy merchants who had supported Charles the Bold. These supposed turncoats were put to death. With her life in danger, Mary was forced to summon the Estates of Flanders, the representative body. She had no choice but to grant them the right to convene whenever they wanted and to veto any declaration of war. On top of that, Mary had to restore all the liberties and privileges Philip the Good and Charles the Bold had taken away from Ghent. The other great cities of the region, like Bruges and Ypres, were no less aware of the opportunity they had now that Charles the Bold was dead. Burgundian rule, which had lasted for more than a century, effectively collapsed within weeks. Shut up in Ghent, surrounded by enemies, Mary needed a way out. The only card she had to play was marriage, one of the most important tools of dynastic politics. Marriage to an eligible man who could counterbalance the forces arrayed against her.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. Because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Take off 15 discount not applicable to partner-operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know.
In the still icy and freezing February of 1477, Mary of Burgundy's future looked bleak. But she wasn't entirely without allies. She had her father's chancellor, a man named Guillaume Hugonet. She had the Lord of Humbercourt, an accomplished diplomat and soldier. She had her uncle Louis, the Bishop of Liège, who wasn't much of a cleric, but he happened to be a pretty well-connected political figure. And most important of all, she had her stepmother, Margaret of York, the sister of King Edward IV of England, who adored Mary and had taken an active role in raising her. This collection of wheelers, dealers, and quasi-royal figures all had resources of their own. More important, they had connections to other players within the game of dynastic politics. Now was the time for them to leverage those connections to Mary's benefit. The answer to Mary's problem was clear: marriage. Even before his death, Charles had weighed many proposals for her. It wasn't lost on anybody within the European scene what a valuable prize Mary's inheritance would be. Charles had heard proposals from Aragon to the Ferdinand who eventually married Isabella of Castile, from the younger brother of Louis XI of France, and from the Duke of Lorraine, who controlled a chunk of territory next to Charles's, which the Duke deeply, deeply wanted to control, and eventually went to war and died for. But the very last proposal, the one Charles had pondered just before his death, was to the son of the Holy Roman Emperor. This had represented a desperate hope for aid in Charles's hour of greatest need. But now things had changed. It was all up to Mary to decide. To what end would she marry, and to whom? What were her goals here? Those questions were all intimately connected. Whomever she married would benefit greatly. He would take on Mary's collection of claims to rule over an extensive collection of lands. There was no guarantee the new husband would actually get all of them. In fact, given Louis's recent moves to retake portions of the Burgundian inheritance, this was more a question of what could be salvaged than of grabbing the whole thing. Still, what was left was nothing to sneeze at. Flanders, Holland, Hainaut, Brabant, Gelders, Luxembourg, maybe the imperial county of Burgundy. Those were some of the richest and most densely populated lands in Northern Europe. It was a sweet block of territory for any eligible, enterprising dynast. Each of those dynasts offered a different balance of opportunity and risk. There were three major contenders for Mary's hand, each of which represented a different confluence of interests for Mary's advisors and for the heiress herself. First up was George, Duke of Clarence, brother of King Edward IV of England and of Margaret of York, Mary's stepmother. He was by far the weakest candidate. He was recently widowed, he had no real power base of his own, and he had done little of note in his life aside from regularly betraying his brother and king when the opportunity presented itself. That's something we talked about quite a bit back in our episodes on the Wars of the Roses. Margaret of York was deeply fond of her brother George, but that was his only real qualification. Nobody was really confused about George's limitations, so Edward IV offered another candidate, a guy named Anthony Woodville, Earl Rivers, the brother of his wife the Queen, and one of the most chivalrous knights in Europe. But he was a poor choice, so England was out. The second candidate offered Mary the most straightforward path out of her current predicament. This young man was the Dauphin Charles, then 7 years old, the son of Louis XI, and the heir to the French throne. If the Dauphin Charles married the Burgundian heiress, well, the whole game would be up. Louis already held Picardy, Artois, and Burgundy, and he might get back wealthy Flanders as part of France in perpetuity. The other territories, the ones that were part of the Holy Roman Empire, would be icing on a particularly lucrative cake. There was a substantial age difference between Charles and Mary. He was 12 years her junior, and she was only 19, but that was no real impediment. The marriage itself would be the key dynastic bond. Three of Mary's close advisors, her father's Chancellor Hugonet, the Lord of Humbercourt, and her uncle Louis, the Bishop of Liège, were all in favor of this match. So was King Louis XI, for obvious reasons, who had actually pursued this possibility well before the death of Charles the Bold. Given the relationship between the two men, Charles had been less interested, for fairly obvious reasons. But now the situation had changed, and the Dauphin might have the inside track to the marriage. The final candidate was the one Charles the Bold had seemed set on just before his death, Maximilian, the 17-year-old son of the Holy Roman Emperor Frederick III. Maximilian was a member of the Habsburg dynasty. The Habsburgs would be one of the major players of the early modern period. They would rule everywhere from the Philippines to the Balkans, and they lasted as one of Europe's ruling families all the way up to the end of the First World War. In February of 1477, though, the Habsburgs weren't globe-spanning dynasts. They were just one of the important families at the center of the deeply convoluted politics of the Holy Roman Empire. The Habsburgs had already been around for centuries. They got their start in what's now Switzerland and southwestern Germany all the way back in the 11th century and acquired Austria, the lands for which they're best known, in the 13th. At various points, they acquired other lands and split into branches. One of those branches had briefly acquired the rule of Hungary and Bohemia a generation prior to the death of Charles the Bold. Albert II, Frederick III's cousin, had been crowned King of the Romans, the title that preceded coronation as Holy Roman Emperor. Albert II was briefly one of the most powerful men in Europe, but he died early. Frederick III, Maximilian's father, reached unparalleled heights for a Habsburg. Election as Holy Roman Emperor, the titular leader of a motley collection of territories, mostly in what's now Germany. But despite his ascension to this elevated title, Frederick III was perpetually penniless. He was often basically powerless, he was occasionally besieged by his own subjects, and was betrayed by even his close family members. Frederick was not an attractive or an imposing man. Surviving portraits give his face a troubled, hangdog look, as if he was perpetually worn down by the troubles of this world. Still, Frederick III never stopped plotting. He never stopped looking for opportunities to acquire and extend Habsburg dynastic claims on territories and rights. Above all, Frederick was a survivor. In the end, he simply outlasted most of his opponents, from his disloyal brother Sigismund to Louis XI of France to the powerful king of Hungary, Matthias Corvinus. In his son, Maximilian, Frederick knew he had that rarest and most valuable of dynastic assets, a talented, strapping, nearly adult male heir. Maximilian was marriageable, and in the world of dynastic politics, marriage was the most powerful tool available. Here now, in the icy winter of 1477, was an opportunity to exploit that asset to the fullest. Charles the Bold and Frederick III had agreed on the marriage of Mary and Maximilian before the Duke's death, but with Louis advancing on Flanders and Maximilian hundreds of miles away, nothing was set in stone. All Louis had to do was take possession of Mary's person. That would void any prior deal between Charles and Frederick. But Louis was more concerned with taking territory and cutting deals with the elites of Picardy and Artois than grabbing a hold of Mary of Burgundy. Shut up in Ghent, with the populace up in arms, Mary wasn't going anywhere. Or so Louis thought. There would be plenty of time to take her, marry her to the Dauphin Charles, and complete the acquisition of Burgundian lands to the north. But Louis's normally astute political analysis missed some important factors. Time was a major issue here. He miscalculated in assuming that Mary, her stepmother Margaret of York, and Maximilian would all simply act according to the king's schedule. Louis sent an envoy ahead of him to Ghent to try to secure the marriage, but he chose poorly. The man's name was Olivier Ledam, and he was a former valet and court barber. His main qualification for this mission was that he happened to be Flemish. This man made a mess of things. Mary and her court thought he was a vulgar buffoon. His proposal to place Mary under French quote-unquote protection if she agreed to the marriage with the Dauphin was frankly unacceptable. On top of that, he tried to play off the tensions between Mary, her court, and the city, but he terribly miscalculated. The citizens of Ghent wanted the freedom to manage their own affairs, not French overlordship. The Genthois then seized, tried, and publicly executed two of Mary's counselors who had been in favor of the French marriage. In April of 1477, 3 months after Charles the Bold's death, Louis XI was busily besieging and cajoling the towns of northern France. He executed the envoys of the city of Arras when they tried to run off to negotiate with Mary of Burgundy and then publicly displayed their heads. The king was in an exuberant mood. His great enemy Charles was dead. Burgundy was no more. A vast swath of territory was his for the taking. Louis had spent almost his entire reign working on this one project, and he was finally almost finished. As Louis slowly and deliberately made his way north, content in the knowledge that he was unchallenged, the other players in this game were making their own moves. While Louis was writing sardonic letters about the dead envoys from Arras, making jokes about their decapitations, emissaries from Frederick III were arriving in Ghent. They carried with them a letter from Maximilian and a diamond ring, a symbol of the existing offer of marriage. Mary immediately agreed, saying that she consented to the match. 2 days later, on April 21st, Mary and Maximilian were married by proxy. 4 months later, after Louis spent the whole summer campaigning up and down the former territories of Charles the Bold, Maximilian entered Ghent and married Mary of Burgundy in person on August 18th. Seemingly trapped in a dangerous and unfavorable scenario, Mary of Burgundy and her stepmother Margaret of York had played their few cards perfectly. They had chosen well. So who was this young man who had seen the opportunity this unsettled moment presented and seized his chance? He was 18 years old at the time of the marriage, fit and athletic, and carried himself with a strong and upright posture. A broad chest extended upward to a thick bull neck, and above that, the prominent Habsburg jaw and jutting nose. He wasn't the most attractive man, but there was a keen intelligence lurking behind his eyes. Maximilian loved riding, hunting, jousting, and fighting, all the activities a Renaissance prince was supposed to love. He had a flair for the big occasion and a master's grasp of public perception and the popular mood. He was the first European ruler to truly grasp the potential of the printing press for spreading propaganda, for example. In coming years, Maximilian would grow into one of the master manipulators of European politics. Wily, sharp, always looking to play the angles available to him, utterly amoral when it came to securing advantages for himself and his heirs. And his wedding to Mary had done just that. This also meant that Louis XI, on his victory march north, had miscalculated. He looked ascendant from the outside. The combination of his armies and his envoys had succeeded in establishing control over many of the former Burgundian territories. Even beyond the technical boundaries of France, in the former imperial lands Charles the Bold had held, Louis was making deals and winning friends. But these were all short-term gains. Even as the King of France was winning these important battles, he was losing the broader war. Remember, the politics of this period was all about claims to rights. Conquering lands and cutting deals with local elites did nothing to invalidate the claims to rulership that Mary of Burgundy and her new husband were capable of making. All of those claims would have been in Louis' possession had he forced Mary to wed his son, the Dauphin Charles. There would have been other conflicts, sure, but none so deep-rooted and intractable. Focusing on the lands instead of Mary was the greatest miscalculation of Louis' long and effective reign as king. What's more, he knew it almost immediately. So did his associates. Philippe de Comines, the memoirist and one of the great political minds of this period, a close advisor of the king, called Louis' actions in this time a very great failing of judgment. In fact, Comines uses this episode as the root of an extended and very smart meditation on the importance of listening to advice and sticking to sound plans once they're made. It was as if the downfall of Charles the Bold and the opportunities of the moment caused him to lose sight of the long-term implications of his actions. With Louis making such uncharacteristic mistakes, the power couple of Maximilian and Mary had options and potential allies. Mary's stepmother's brother was the King of England, Edward IV, who wasn't especially fond of Louis. Even now, as he was slipping into obesity, drunkenness, and even greater dedication to pursuing his many mistresses, Edward IV was still a formidable political operator. He could take this opportunity to support his stepniece's claims, maybe seize some territory from Louis, and secure another nice cash settlement to go away. But as it happened, Louis snapped back to reality quite quickly once news of the marriage of Mary and Maximilian reached him. He sent a resident ambassador to England. This ambassador managed to keep Edward so busy with gifts and plots that he never got around to helping out Mary and Maximilian. In the short term, Maximilian was forced to concede an unfavorable truce with Louis in the summer of 1478. The next year, 1479, Louis was back at it, trying to press his claims to the rest of the Burgundian inheritance. No help was forthcoming from the princes of the Holy Roman Empire, or even his father the emperor, for the 20-year-old Maximilian. He and Mary were effectively on their own. Maximilian managed to beg enough tax money from the representative bodies of Flanders and the rest of the Netherlands that he could buy an army of mercenaries to fight the powerful French forces of Louis XI. Improbably, Maximilian won. He showed great personal bravery, dismounting and fighting on foot with his soldiers, repelling a thunderous charge of French men-at-arms in a vicious melee. But the situation was still desperate, and 3 more years of off-and-on campaigning followed before a final treaty between Maximilian and Louis settled things at the end of 1482. In the meantime, Mary and Maximilian had 2 children, a boy, Philip, and a girl, Margaret. By all accounts, they were a happy and well-matched couple who enjoyed hunting and riding together. Tragically, their leisure activities were also the cause of Mary's demise. Out hunting one day in 1482 with Maximilian and a crowd of nobles, her horse tripped, threw her into a ditch, and then fell on top of her. She suffered serious internal injuries and died several weeks later, aged only 25. Mary of Burgundy had only a brief life, but her impossibly rich inheritance was the root cause of centuries of dynastic conflict. Her Habsburg husband and their descendants now held huge lands stretching from Flanders and Holland through the Rhineland into Austria, concentrating more and more land in the hands of a single dynasty. The potential for conflict with the Valois of France along these borders was endless. The treaty Louis and Maximilian signed shortly after her death was only a brief stopgap. Future generations of Habsburgs and Valois would fight war after war, many of them over competing claims to territory laid out in the Burgundian inheritance. French armies ranged into the Rhineland and Flanders. Habsburg troops burned villages in northern and eastern France for years to come. An accident of dynastic politics, the fight for the hand of Mary of Burgundy produced a structural situation of conflict between rival dynasties that lasted for generations. If only Louis XI had remembered that dynastic marriage trumped everything else, that whole situation, the defining fault line of early modern politics, might never have come to pass.
Patrick, would you ever fire me from the show?
No. Maybe. Depends on whether you keep lying about finishing books.
Wow, that was truly hurtful.
It'd be really hard because who would I hire? You have a huge impact on the show. It's so important to find the right person for your business, and the idea of finding another Leah sounds both impossible and more than a little frightening.
Here's a thought exercise, though. How would you even go about finding another me? You could post on a job board, but you're pretty much leaving it up to the universe to find the right person.
No, I wouldn't leave something like that up to chance. I would go to LinkedIn, where great people go every day to make connections and discover job opportunities.
Oh, that sounds really nice. I think like 70% of the U.S. workforce is on LinkedIn, and I'm pretty sure it's the best way to get your job opportunity in front of the people who are qualified and ready for something new.
A new hire is made every 10 seconds using LinkedIn. So go to linkedin.com/tides and get $50 off your first job post. That's linkedin.com/tides to get $50 off your first job post. LinkedIn.com/tides. Terms and conditions apply.
Patrick, don't even think about going there.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know, after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used. Because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
The marriage of Mary and Maximilian is a beautiful encapsulation of how dynastic politics functioned in this period. The fundamental theme of this era was consolidation. More and more claims to territories grew concentrated in fewer and fewer hands. Powerful rulers were able to squash some of the challenges to their claims to rights within the territories they already controlled. Those rulers could better coordinate, generally speaking, the various units that made up their kingdom or principality or what have you. The distinctions between internal and external politics got stronger. It got harder for the Duke of Bourbon, say, to have an independent political relationship with the Holy Roman Emperor or the King of England outside what the King of France wanted him to have. Dynastic states, what the historian John Watts calls regnal polities, weren't the only kind of political unit on the European stage at this point. There were two other major types: city-states and leagues of towns and cities. Venice, Florence, Milan, and Genoa were city-states. So were Strasbourg and Cologne. They could be very powerful. Venice maintained an overseas empire, including the entire island of Crete and a series of strategic ports all over the eastern Mediterranean. Milan controlled a big chunk of northern Italy, and at times it acted more like a dynastic state than a city-state. Its dukes, the Viscontis, then the Sforzas, were major players in broader European politics, with Louis XI and Charles the Bold allied with them. Strasbourg and Cologne had actually played a key role as part of the alliance that brought down Charles the Bold. There could be a great deal of variation within these city-states. Most were oligarchies. They were ruled by a squabbling group of powerful patrician families, but others had single rulers. Some controlled big surrounding territories, and others were effectively limited to the city and its immediate environs. But all of them shared in common that the focus was the main city. Florence's holdings in Tuscany were for the benefit of Florence and its elite, and subject cities got very little or no say in what happened to them. Venice's Stato di Mar, its overseas empire, existed for the enrichment of Venetians. Its inhabitants were not equal partners in that project. As a general rule, the city-states that survived into the later 15th century tended to be situated at the nodes of major trade routes. They were densely populated and they were extremely rich. Their wealth and their often sophisticated governing institutions allowed them to harness a surprising amount of resources for making war, too. After city-states, we have leagues of towns. We just met one in last week's episode, the Swiss Confederation, which was an association of towns and rural communities. The most famous one of this period was the Hanseatic League, the organization of trading cities around the Baltic and the North Seas. They were looser than regnal polities, and they were less focused than city-states, with less surrounding territory to worry about. Like city-states, they tended to be trading cities. They might be quite wealthy. Some of the Hansa cities like Lübeck and Hamburg certainly were. But they had far fewer resources to draw on than city-states. Their trade tended to be less in high-value or luxury products than cheap bulk goods with lower margins. That said, they too could be quite powerful. We've already seen how the Swiss thrashed Charles the Bold, and the Hansa probably had the most advanced and powerful navy outside the Mediterranean until well into the 16th century. The point of bringing up these alternative models is to emphasize that dynastic states weren't the only players in the game at the end of the 15th century. The kinds of innovations in governance that we see in this period weren't limited to dynastic states either. Things like diplomacy and sophisticated state financial tools, like a permanent public debt, were actually pioneered by city-states. But even with these alternative models, we've spent so much time on dynastic states because, over the course of the next couple of centuries, dynastic states were the model that won. City-states and town leagues fell behind, with a couple of notable exceptions. The second half of the 15th century, the period we're talking about here today, was the key turning point in that process. The aftermath of the death of Charles the Bold and the marriage of Maximilian and Mary was one key step in that process. In the course of just a few months, a huge chunk of new territory passed into the hands of an already established dynasty. The Habsburgs weren't yet on par with the other established royal families of Europe, like the Trastámaras of Castile and Aragon or the Valois of France, but they had extensive lands and an even broader portfolio of claims. Mary of Burgundy's inheritance gave them a whole other set of claims that would pass to her now Habsburg descendants. This marriage was the first domino to fall in a much larger set of dynastic consolidations. Philip the Handsome, the son of Mary and Maximilian, was the linchpin in amassing a whole new set of dynastic claims. From his mother, he inherited the entirety of the old Burgundian lands in Florence, Holland, and Luxembourg. Had he outlived his father Maximilian, which he didn't, he would have inherited Austria and the other passel of Habsburg lands in Central Europe. But it was his marriage to Juana of Castile, the eldest daughter of Isabella and Ferdinand, that had the most momentous long-term effects. Isabella and Ferdinand had a son, but he died relatively young, leaving them with two daughters, Catherine of Aragon, who would go on to marry Henry VIII of England and set off a whole other set of key developments, and Juana, the elder of the two. With her brother dead, Juana would inherit both Castile and Aragon, two of the three major kingdoms of the Iberian Peninsula. By marrying, Philip and Juana would unite the Habsburg inheritance, the Burgundian inheritance, and that whole set of Spanish inheritances as well. On top of all that, by virtue of the Spanish conquests in the New World, the heirs of Philip and Juana would eventually rule territories stretching from the Andes Mountains of Peru to the Ottoman fortresses in Hungary. This was dynastic consolidation in a nutshell. More than anything else, I think this was the key advantage that dynastic states held over their city-state and town league competitors. The capacity for both exceptionally rapid, seemingly overnight, and also slow, generational expansion by means of dynastic marriages. If a city-state wanted new territory, it mostly needed to either conquer or purchase it. We see a lot of the former, conquest, and the massively confused 15th century politics of Italy. City-states like Venice and Milan poured huge amounts of money and resources into eating their smaller neighbors, but when they actually fought each other, it was basically a geopolitical stalemate. Comparatively little territory actually permanently changed hands in those sporadic and expensive conflicts. Town leagues could convince or bully new cities into joining them, like the Swiss did throughout the 15th century and the Hansa had done for centuries. They could conquer territory too. Now, conquest was, of course, an option for dynastic states. Isabella and Ferdinand famously conquered Muslim Granada in the 1480s and early 1490s, and Charles the Bold had taken small bites of territory adjacent to his own throughout his reign. But compared to marriage, conquest was expensive in money and lives. It was hard to scale. Large city-states took over smaller ones, but not each other. Charles the Bold conquered tiny Guelders, but not much larger Lorraine. Conquest was also uncertain. It actively worked against the key factor that allowed a new ruler to establish his rule over new territory: the buy-in of the local elites, whether they were urban patricians or rural nobles or representative institutions. Remember, politics of this time was all about claims to rights. Right to rule by conquest was not an especially strong claim. A dynastic claim, on the other hand, like one you got by marriage, was potentially very strong. Now, it still wasn't certain. it could require a ton of negotiation with existing powers. But those local elites were much more likely to go along with you if you'd acquired a claim by marriage than by burning their castles and cities and killing their soldiers in battle. Here's a good example of this. The marriage of Mary of Burgundy and Maximilian passed along the Burgundian inheritance to their son, Philip. After Mary's early death, it wasn't a given that the fractious cities of these territories would consent to be ruled by a basically foreign prince, Maximilian, until Philip the Handsome came of age. But Maximilian negotiated, he made deals, and he agreed to concessions. He had to give things up, including quite a bit of autonomy and revenue, but he maintained the dynastic claims to rule over these lands. Those were claims that his son and grandson and their future descendants all made great use of, in combination with their huge number of claims elsewhere. Everybody in the game agreed that dynastic claims on territorial rulership were valid from generation to generation. They were durable and convincing. I want to come back to the marriage of Philip the Handsome and Juana of Castile that I mentioned earlier. This took place in 1496, but it really became key in 1504, when Queen Isabella of Castile died. This made Juana and Philip and their descendants the heirs to that kingdom. So, this marriage united the Habsburg inheritance, the Burgundian inheritance, and the Spanish inheritance all in one claim. The Burgundian inheritance was itself the result of the marriage of Philip the Bold and Margaret of Mall back in the late 14th century, which gave their descendants claims on Flanders and whatnot. Other pieces of that likewise came from dynastic marriages, and a few others from purchase or conquest. Philip, as heir of both Maximilian and Mary of Burgundy, held all those claims. The Spanish inheritance, Castile and Aragon, was the result of the dynastic marriage of Ferdinand and Isabella, which united the claims to the two powerful and independent kingdoms in the person of Juana. So, the marriage of Philip and Juana was the final domino falling in a long line of previous dynastic consolidations. Claims to larger and larger chunks of territory got combined in fewer and fewer claimants. Smaller territories like Brabant and Hainaut got attached to Flanders and Holland. They got attached to the Habsburg lands of Central Europe. Those Habsburg lands in Central Europe were themselves the product of long-term consolidations. Those territories were then attached to the Spanish lands of Isabella and Ferdinand, which were themselves assembled out of a different process of long-term consolidation. The later 15th century was the tipping point where those chunks of territory reached a critical size and importance. The Habsburg/Burgundy/Spanish combination is the clearest and most obvious example of this large-scale dynastic consolidation. But it was happening elsewhere, too. The Valois Dukes of Burgundy weren't the only dynasty going around collecting titles and claims. So were the Valois-Anjou, another cadet branch of the Valois family, who picked up claims to the Duchy of Lorraine and the entire Kingdom of Naples in Italy. The main Valois line, the rulers of France, were doing the same. Their key acquisition was the Duchy of Brittany at the northwestern corner of France. It had been practically independent for most of the 15th century. When Brittany's last duke died in 1488, Francis II, who had sheltered Henry Tudor during his years of exile, its rule passed to his daughter Anne. Anne very nearly married the widowed Maximilian, but Maximilian missed his chance this time. Instead, Anne married King Charles VIII of France, Louis XI's son. From that point on, the claim to Brittany was part of the French royal inheritance. Those are just a couple of examples. There were many, many, many more if we really want to dig into this period. It gets especially confusing if we head to East Central Europe, to Hungary, to Poland, Lithuania, Bohemia, and the Holy Roman Empire. But the overall pattern was clear. More claims concentrated in fewer hands, with marriage as the key tool available to dynasts to make that happen. All politics in this period was personal, and nothing was more personal than dynastic marriage. Louis XI forgot that at a key moment. The consequences were momentous. In the cutthroat world of European politics, size mattered. It's not that dynastic states were uniquely aggressive in the way they went after new territories and rights. The constant war-making of Milan and Venice and the Swiss towns argues strongly against their uniqueness. Everybody got bigger. Everybody consolidated as the 15th century went on, not just dynastic states. It's just that as time went on and dynastic rulers of increasingly extensive lands gained access to more and more resources, the competitive balance shifted in their favor. Consolidation worked much more effectively in their favor over the long term. They would dominate the 16th century, but their rise began here, with marriages like that of Mary of Burgundy and Maximilian. Next time on Tides, we'll talk about how these dynastic states actually function, the tools they used in the expansion of their power, diplomacy, increasingly complex state finance, and a new class of highly educated civil servants to run the whole machine. Until then, thanks so much for joining me. Be sure and drop me a line if you'd like to chat about the fall of the Roman Empire or the rise of the modern world. You can find me on Twitter at @Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at @PatrickWymanMMA. You can follow the show at Tides History. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The sound design is by Derek Behrens for Airship. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Leah Sutherland. From Wondery, the executive producer is Hernan Lopez. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
Let's jump into Peppa's world of play. Look for spring flowers, hunt for muddy puddles, and bravely explore exciting places with Peppa play sets. Peppa Pig, inspiring kid confidence.